Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm thrilled to have as my guest Jeff Dyer, who's written a book called White Sands. Its subtitle is Experiences from the Outside World. Other people have described it as a book of essays. I don't know how they've decided that that's what it is. It's a book of experiences from the outside world. Now, what are experiences from the outside world?
Well, I'm glad that you're not entirely comfortable with that description of it as a book of essays. I'm certainly not. We'll come back to that. But yeah, let's start with the subtitle, Experiences from the Outside World. It's taken from Lawrence's essay on New Mexico, where famously he said that, you know, when he first took in this sort of vast landscape, he said it was the greatest experience from the outside world he'd ever had. So I guess at the most literal level, we could say it's about the external world as opposed to the world that takes place in buildings. But I think the Lawrence thing is important because there's a distinction maybe between the internal world in his head and the external world out there.
A friend of mine, before I'd read the travel writings of D.H. Lawrence, said to me that Lawrence is famous because he practically gets off the train or plane, gets into the hotel room, sits in his notebook and writes, "The reason I hate this place is," and he was a really great hater. And his experiences in those books, Phoenix 1 and Phoenix 2, of the landscape around Taos, are some of the loveliest things. Lawrence really knows somehow when he's in the presence of mystery or the sacred, and he finds it there, and he decides that instead of hating it, he'll put words to it. Almost like someone writing lyrics to a song, he's writing the lyrics to New Mexico. It's astounding. This is Jeff Dyer's American book, or his most American book. It's not as if he hasn't written about American places before, but the thrilling thing about this is he prepares us for an understanding of the American landscape by going to Tahiti, where Gauguin went. He goes and finds that the Tahiti Gauguin painted is not there in Tahiti, perhaps was never there. And so we're led to understand that the American spaces, the Spiral Jetty, for instance, it may be on vacation when Jeff Dyer and his wife arrive. And it may be perfectly well there. You know, the Spiral Jetty is sometimes underwater, and sometimes the water level sinks, and the jetty is purely visible. The jetty was invisible for how many years was it?
Good long while. I'm tempted to say it was certainly more than 10 years, because when it was built, the water level was unusually low. And then, So when the water went up to its normal level, it disappeared, but then it reappeared in new, improved form, all glittering and covered with salt crystals.
And not only that, by the time it reappears, Smithson, the designer of the spiral jetty, is dead.
Yeah.
And it became a great mythological space whose emptiness is there to be written about by those who write about the soul of places, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And you even say, beautifully, that you're not sure whether the presence of the jetty when you visit it is better than its absence.
I do like this idea that during the years when it was invisible, that there's this nice kind of paradox, really, that it's land art, it's earth art, it is by definition substantial. But I love this idea that for a little while, this substantial thing became purely conceptual.
First, America is placed in the context of Tahiti. Then the spiral jetty is placed in the context of the lightning field, some place that really is there. There is a there. You have to stay into the night to see it. It's not there when you arrive, but this other piece of earth art is magnificent and huge, and you wish that you could have spent several days, if not weeks, there, even though, again, it will test a writer's every ability to describe what it is to be seen when you're there, yeah?
Except with the nice thing that the lightning field has going for it is that it's an experience of place that unfolds over time. And of course, once that happens, I mean, what you've got there is a pretty much a synonym of narrative. And of course, once you've got narrative, then you're in the realm of the very thing that writing is quite well geared to articulate.
And these places yield not architects, but artists. The spiral jetty, designed by Robert Smithson. The lightning field by, is it Walter DeMaria?
Yeah.
And next to these, you've placed the Forbidden City in something that I'm convinced is one of the cases where that essay is mostly an invention.
Well, I feel I'm not the person to ask about that. I mean, it's one of the fun things, I hope, about reading my stuff, about not being sure exactly what it is. But, it's partly an essay on the Forbidden City, but the Forbidden City is a sort of operating there as a metaphor as well.
Yes. And the world is becoming metaphorical as you go through this book. In fact, at a certain point, the world disappears into the writing about it in the essay, the title essay, called White Sands, in which the sand is so white and it's so fine that it rises into the road and causes a complete ocular occlusion so that you can't see in the white sands.
Yeah. I think in the first version of that story that I published in Granta, it began with a bit of dialogue where I think in sort of dialogue we ended up speaking the famous lines from the Shelley Elegy for Keats, you know, life like a dome of many colored glass stains the white radiance of eternity. And it seemed that in White Sands we really did have the white radiance of eternity, because it's there's no time there, there's no, you know, there's just none of the sort of markers that define a place.
We're talking about obliteration then. And we're talking eventually, by the final essay in this book, this very wonderful book, White Sands, which is published by Pantheon, we're talking about the intimation of mortality. We're talking about a stroke which the author with me, Jeff Dyer, suffers. It's a minor stroke, a small stroke, but probably a small stroke occasions more thinking about mortality than a stroke that kills you. Because a killing stroke ends all thought.
Yeah, yeah. But there are many gradations of stroke between the one that kills you and the sort I have. And at the risk of being flippant, you know, if you were going to have a stroke, I'd thoroughly recommend the one I had, which just left my, just wiped out the vision in half of my vision for a very short period of time.
Half of your vision in each of your eyes, yes?
That was the confusing thing about it, in that it just came out of nowhere. My wife and I, we'd only been living in Venice, California, for a week, I think. And then, yeah, I just stuffed some garbage into the garbage, and I stood up, and it was like half the world had disappeared, but at the same time, it was still there. It was very, very confusing, and I kept trying to work out what had happened by covering up one eye and then the other, because I sort of couldn't see anything going on on the left side, but I sort of could. It's very, very difficult to articulate. But to cut a long story short, after we go to the hospital to see the optometrist, because I thought I had an eye problem, you know, she covered up my left eye and said, "Can you see anything off to the left?" And I couldn't at all. She covered up my right eye and said, "What you can see?" And I said, "I still can't see anything up in the left." And that very simple test established, to my horror, she said, "Oh, well, you know, that means your eyes are fine. It means the problem is that it's in your brain. So you need to get down to the emergency room straight away."
And you see, it must have felt extraordinary, since you'd written a book called Jeff in Venice, Death in Veronese.
Yeah.
This is now a different Venice and a different kind of intimation of death, but you've been, as a writer, someone who's sought out those queasy in-between moments where you look for the thing that is not there or no longer there. Fascinating to me, you wrote an essay that I would have assumed many people would have written, but you seem to be the one to have thought of it. You go to visit the place where Theodore Adorno was living in Brentwood.
Yeah.
He was living there in the 30s. He was living in a community that included Brecht and Schoenberg and Stravinsky. Wasn't Stravinsky living in West Hollywood?
It's amazing. They were all there. And crucially, of course, Thomas Mann.
Thomas Mann. In other words, Los Angeles was the center of expatriate culture. And it's a Los Angeles that doesn't quite exist anymore, except when occasionally people play the film scores that some of the musicians who came here, and they were supporting themselves in ways they'd never had when they were exponents of the 12-tone row.
Yeah, exactly. And much as they despised the kind of, you know, the vulgarity and the commercialism and the crass materialism of America as represented by Hollywood, it didn't take long of them, many of them, very long to realize that they'd quite like a piece of that action too. But it's just this extraordinary thing that they were all living here, of all places, all within proximity of each other.
And you write about, in that marvelous essay, the very young Susan Sontag, I think she's still a teenager.
14, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who goes to visit with a school chum, the Mons, in Santa Monica Canyon. She writes a piece called Pilgrimage. You call this essay Pilgrimage. And you cite something I'd forgotten from that incredible piece of Susan's. She says about meeting Thomas Mann, "I wanted him to talk like a book. I was expecting someone to talk like a book. Instead, he talked like a book review."
Yeah, it's one of the rare jokes in the Sontag opus. I think. And I should say that I wasn't aware of that. I wasn't aware of Sontag's visit to Thomas Mann until after making my own pilgrimage to the Adorno House. But yeah, there was a nice connection there, because it means that that pilgrimage, the physical pilgrimage I make to the Adorno House, that's paralleled by the way that the piece in turn becomes a kind of, you know, written pilgrimage stroke homage to Sontag, in whose footsteps I'm treading in, you know, in various ways.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Jeff Dyer about his book, White Sands, Experiences from the Outside World. We'll continue after this short break.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Jeff Dyer about his latest book, White Sands, Experiences from the Outside World, an exploration of space and place and time that attempts to decipher landscapes and how we interact with them, even in their absence. You've written a previous book about D.H. Lawrence. In this book, we find the extent of your debt to D.H. Lawrence. And it's rather a remarkable debt because, you know, after all, D.H. Lawrence writes the great book on American literature,
classic studies
in American literature. Mm-hmm. And this, Jeff Dyer's book, White Sands, is certainly one of the great books about America. And the truth is, you can't write an essay about America because it can't be located. In essay after essay, we find in the title essay, for instance, an incident, and the essay closes with the characters wondering whether they've just participated in an incident of racism. But they're not quite sure. They didn't want to have. They wouldn't have wanted to have, and yet they feel perhaps they were inevitably promulgated into a landscape of racism by a sign that told them that in this neighborhood there are several detention areas. They've already picked up a hitchhiker.
Yeah, the signs warn. After they've picked up the hitchhiker, within minutes they come to a sign saying, do not pick up hitchhikers. Detention facilities in area. And you're absolutely right to pick up the racial thing, because it's in a story called White Sands.
And it's kind of amazing because the narrator says to the hitchhiker, now listen, we're all feeling lousy. This has made us very uncool.
Uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable. And, of course, the hitchhiker, who's striving for a condition of perfect honesty, says, well, you see, I have been in prison, but not recently. Mm-hmm. You see, my wife, and a story that's about to be too horrible to hear or too innocent to tell, begins and doesn't finish. Eventually, this hitchhiker is abandoned in an act of betrayal that the husband and wife of the story agree we should go back and get him, but we're not going to, are we? No, we're not. And they laugh, and they define an American experience of not knowing how to respond to a difficult circumstance that is very powerful and at the same time scarily trivial, yeah?
Mm-hmm. But that thing of not knowing how to respond is hopefully something repeated by the reader, because one is, as you read this story, I hope people find it very, very funny. At the same time, it's rather, there's a sinister side to it as well. So, yeah, I just hope that that kind of uncertainty is replicated. They're in the car. They're not sure of the nature of the experience they're having. Have they picked up somebody who's just got out of the detention facility, or have they picked up a hitchhiker who just unfortunately has ended up, has been dropped in a place where, you know, the chances of getting a ride are very, very slim. But there's other things going on there as well, that uncertainty about what the passenger, you know, what is happening and what has happened. You know, I think it operates on a larger scale as well, because you've described it as an essay. But, you know, I would say to you, well, is it an essay or is it a story? So
exactly.
That uncertainty is endlessly being repeated.
The mixture of fiction and nonfiction increases the tension in the reader, and it extends into all of the other essays as well. We start to look for the moment of uncertainty. There's a woman who's introduced as a tour guide to the Forbidden City, but it seems like she might in fact be a call woman or some kind of sexual friend who's been invited on the tour, and she confesses, I know nothing about the Forbidden City.
Mm, but she certainly stands as the person who could potentially grant admission to a different kind of forbidden experience.
Exactly. And you see, the very first story, essay, I don't even know what to call it, incitement. We're thrown off our guards. The author knows that to tell us that Tahitians, yes, he says, and I quote, the younger Tahitians are babes. These are the people Gauguin painted. But as they age, they become monumental, hugely fat. They waddle. And as we read this passage, we both laugh at its daring and are appalled because the author will stop at nothing because he's tired of being told to stop.
Uh-huh.
He's tired of being told where to draw the line. And there will be no drawing of the line for the purposes of decorum. Lines may be drawn, but not out of politeness.
And we come back once again to that key, you know, the central thing in the book, White Sands, that, you know, what happens? You're in White Sands, you're on the road, and then at a certain point, the road gets whiter and whiter until it just dissolves into the landscape around it. In the same way that in some of the pieces, yeah, you've got this obvious sort of narrative thing, you know, road and narrative, they're the same. But with a narrative, with typical short stories, you get a sense of, you know, where you're going. But I like the idea that at a certain point in many of these pieces, you don't know what you are or what you're reading.
And furthermore, you see, that ocular fastation that occurs in White Sands recurs in a form in the final essay when vision is assaulted with a stroke. And we as readers say, is he aware of this is a very indirect way of showing us that we lose our vision constantly, that we lose our bearings, that we fail to know at any given moment who or where we are, which is a question that's a famous question in the title of one of Gauguin's greatest canvases. So in other words, the essay, which usually acts as an act of definition, gives way to the story, which usually acts as a form. It's like the closest thing prose has to poetry. It's a form of ambiguity. It's a Chinese flower that opens but not fully. And so we read with astonishment what the author is doing with the form, which is in fact the goal of the artist, to take the form and bring it somewhere it hasn't been. It's what you're writing about the Watts Towers, that they might as well be because they are nowhere else.
But crucially as well, this idea of, you've got to end up somewhere else, particularly in a travel book. You know, a travel book there are many instances of travel books which are really quite sort of stay-at-home books. There's an established form that you don't really need to leave. Whereas it seems to me that any travel book, to be successful, it's got to depart somewhat from the mold of being, from the template of being a travel book. It's got to leave some stuff behind. And one of the things that hopefully this book leaves behind, one of the things is that comfortable sense of knowing exactly what it is you're reading.
Yes, I found it your most satisfying book in its appeal to incomprehension. I liked it very much because I like incomprehension. I get tired of too much understanding, too much clarity, too much coherence. We're victimized by those things, and what we really need as a culture is to be able to understand our blinded moments.
On the other hand, though, I was going to, because I liked what you were saying there, and I liked this up to a point, but I think it's quite interesting that combination of incomprehension with clarity. Because, I find it frustrating when I'm reading books and I'm not clear what's going on. And I think nearly everything in this book is described and articulated clearly. For example, the description of this completely incomprehensible thing, the stroke. But it's difficult to make sense of. But everything is sort of itemized in quite a properly actualized way, let's say.
I've been talking with Jeff Dyer, author of White Sands, Experiences from the Outside World, published by Pantheon. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Always a pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from White Sands, Experiences from the Outside World at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Acting as producer today is Alan Howard, associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt, although at the end of this, I hardly am sure. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Vivian Gornick is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.